Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident, and this will be the 63rd episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts, and we are going to be finishing up cardiac pharmacology today. Today is Thanksgiving, so from the bottom of my heart, I wish all of you a happy Thanksgiving. Regardless of whatever may be going on in your life, remain thankful. I'm on my ICU rotation right now, and I've seen people die. I've seen people have to spend their Thanksgiving in the hospital, which is not the most ideal situation. So just be thankful, okay? Remember, as long as you're alive, you have hope, right? Again, I tell people that a living dog is better than a dead lion, right? So just kind of have hope, you know, do your best, trust God, and things will work out for the best. Okay, so let's begin. So cardiac pharmacology, right? So today I want to start by, you know, saying some differences between three drugs that are sort of like close cousins, nitroglycerin, nitroprusside, and hydralazine. Okay, I think those will be helpful. I'll talk about like commonalities and differences, right? So the thing is, when you think of nitroglycerin, think of it primarily as a venodilator. If you're thinking of nitroprusside, think of it primarily as a venodilator and an arteriolar dilator. Think of it in those two domains, versus hydralazine, that is primarily an arteriolar dilator. Okay, and the thing is, the mechanism of action of hydralazine is kind of unclear, right? But for nitroglycerin, nitroprusside, basically think of them as nitric oxide precursors. And the thing is, remember, right, if you want to make nitric oxide, you start with arginine. So this is just more me saying about, saying a biochemical correlate here. Remember, nitric oxide can be made from arginine. And remember, arginine is a part of the urea cycle, okay? So you make the nitric oxide, and basically the nitric oxide is made in endothelial cells from arginine, and then it diffuses to smooth muscle, and it can activate guanylate cyclase, okay? Guanylate cyclase helps you make cyclic GMP. Okay, and then that cyclic GMP, just like cyclic AMP activates protein kinase A, cyclic GMP will activate protein kinase G. And then when you activate protein kinase G, protein kinase G activates myosin light chain phosphatase. Okay, because remember, right, if myosin is phosphorylated, it's active and you have muscle contraction. But the thing is, for these drugs to be dilators, obviously they must be causing smooth muscle relaxation. So the thing is, you need to dephosphorylate myosin to render it inactive. So that is where myosin light chain phosphatase comes into play. When myosin light chain phosphatase is activated by protein kinase G, okay, myosin light chain phosphatase becomes active, it dephosphorylates myosin, and you no longer have contraction of smooth muscle. So you have relaxation. Okay, so a very high yield to know this. And actually, please don't forget that PDE5, phosphodiesterase 5, breaks down cyclic GMP. Okay, so think about, if you were to inhibit PDE5, you will no longer break down cyclic GMP. Okay, so you have potentiation of the effects of cyclic GMP, and you have vasodilation, for example, right? You could have dilation of the blood vessels that feed the penis, and that can cause that can help with erectile dysfunction. That's how drugs like sildenafil and tadalafil work. Okay, and one other high yield thing to know is, because nitroglycerin is primarily a venodilator, right, it decreases preload, right? Because again, it increases the capacitance of your veins, and by increasing the capacitance of your veins store more blood, right? Less blood goes to the heart, preload decreases, and because your preload is decreasing, you're decreasing myocardial oxygen demand, because the heart does not have to work as hard to pump blood. That is actually the primary mechanism of action behind nitroglycerin being good for angina. Many people think, oh, it dilates your coronary vessels. It does, but that's a very limited mechanism of action. The primary mechanism of action is to decrease your myocardial oxygen demand, okay, by decreasing preload, by being a venodilator. And then for nitroprusside, I want you to think of nitroprusside as being primarily used for hypertensive emergency, okay? It lowers your blood pressure very quickly, okay? Because it's both a venodilator and an arteriolar dilator, it decreases both preload and afterload, okay? And then hydralazine, because it's primarily an arteriolar dilator, it decreases afterload. And then with nitroprusside, one high yield thing you want to remember is that it contains cyanide. Okay, remember, if you have watched the biochem review video, remember that cyanide can bind to complex 4, of the electron transport chain. And by binding to complex 4 of the electron transport chain, you basically decrease ATP production, right? And you can basically go into an energy crisis with a cyanide toxicity. And I mean, obviously, the way you fix this, as I believe I've discussed in a previous podcast or even the biochem lecture, is you give amyl nitrate, right? The amyl nitrate will convert Fe2 plus to Fe3 plus, right? So the ferrous form of iron to the ferric form of iron, because Fe3 plus basically is... If you think of Fe3+, Fe3+ is very good at binding cyanide, okay? And remember, right, hemoglobin contains iron. And usually hemoglobin contains iron in the Fe2+ form, the ferrous form. That's the form that can bind oxygen, okay? When you have heme and globin containing iron that is in the 2+ form, that's hemoglobin. But when you have heme and globin that is bound to iron in the 3+ form or the ferric form, that is methemoglobin. That form cannot bind oxygen. That form of iron actually cannot be reabsorbed in the duodenum. Okay, so Fe2 plus is our preferred ion, but Fe3 plus is good because it helps you make it's very good at binding cyanide. It's very good at binding cyanide. Okay, so that's why if a patient has cyanide toxicity, right, you give them amyl nitrate. It's a powerful oxidizing agent. It will convert the Fe2 plus to Fe3 plus. That binds up the cyanide. And then you give thiosulfate to convert that complex into thiocyanate. And then you pee or poop it out of the body. Okay. And just as a quick reminder from biochem, remember that there is an enzyme known as methemoglobin reductase. Okay, it converts Fe3 plus to Fe2 plus. Okay, methemoglobin reductase is actually activated by methylene blue. Okay, that's why methylene blue can be used to treat methemoglobinemia. And then don't forget with hydralazine, right? Because it decreases your afterload, your heart rate would increase, right? Because it's sort of think of it as a reflex tachycardia. If you decrease afterload, the way your heart that would decrease blood pressure, right? So the way your heart responds per your baroreceptor response is to increase your heart rate. Okay, so you get a strong sympathetic discharge from the brain. I mean, from the brain stem, that causes your B1 receptors, your beta 1 receptors to fire more. Okay. So the thing is, if a patient is getting hydralazine, you can actually blunt that reflex tachycardia by giving a beta 1 selective blocker like atenolol to blunt that effect. And then don't forget that hydralazine is associated with drug-induced lupus, right? So don't forget your antihistone antibodies. And then your PDE inhibitors, right? So your phosphodiesterase inhibitors, I would say for step one, there are probably three groups of PDE inhibitors you want to know. You want to know your PDE3, your PDE4, and your PDE5 inhibitors, okay? And again, all these drugs, because they inhibit phosphodiesterase, they increase, at least for PDE3 and PDE4, those increase your levels of cyclic AMP. For PDE5, those increase your levels of cyclic GMP. So, PDE3 inhibitors, right? The big ones you want to know, you want to know your cilostazol and dipyridamole, okay? Those are actually antiplatelet drugs. But remember, I've talked about this in prior podcasts. Cilostazol, dipyridamole, those are powerful. Especially cilostazol is used for peripheral arterial disease because as you'll see, in fact, I guess I'll go ahead and talk about this now. The thing is, high levels of cyclic AMP do two different things. If you're talking about cardiac muscle versus smooth muscle, okay? High levels of cyclic AMP do two different things. If you're talking about cardiac muscle versus smooth muscle. In cardiac muscle, increased levels of cyclic AMP actually promote contraction of cardiac muscle. But in smooth muscle, high levels of cyclic AMP promote relaxation of smooth muscle. It's very, very high yield to understand that. Because if you understand that, then you should know that if you give cilostazol, which is a PDE3 inhibitor, and your levels of cyclic AMP go up, that can cause relaxation of the smooth muscles that line the blood vessels that are in your lower extremities. That's why cilostazol can be used for the treatment of peripheral arterial disease. Dipyridamole is a PDE3 inhibitor. It's used in the pharmacologic stress test that takes advantage of the coronary steel principle. I've explained this coronary steel principle so many times in previous podcasts. I'll encourage you to go back and listen to those. But basically, in the coronary steel principle, you try to dilate vessels so that you can steal blood away from maximally dilated stenosed cardiac vessels, right? So, to dilate those vessels, to activate the coronary steel principle, you use a PDE3 inhibitor like dipyridamole, okay, to dilate blood vessels because by inhibiting PDE3, it bumps your levels of cyclic AMP, Okay, another drug known as Milrinone is a PDE3 inhibitor. Okay, it's used a lot in cardiology. It's an awesome drug because it does two things, right? It's used to treat like heart failure, right? And one reason it's good, you can even use it in shock, is again, by inhibiting PDE3, right, it increases your levels of cyclic AMP in cardiac muscle. So it's a positive inotrope. It encourages cardiac muscle contraction, but it also increases your levels of cyclic AMP in smooth muscle. So it decreases your afterload because it's relaxing smooth muscle. So in doing that, it's basically increasing your cardiac output and actually decreasing the resistance to flow of blood out of your heart. In fact, some physicians call Milrinone an inodilator, right? Because by increasing cyclic AMP in cardiac and smooth muscle, it basically makes it easier for your heart to pump blood. And then it removes the blockage to the flow of blood out of your heart by decreasing afterload, by relaxing smooth muscles and causing a decrease in afterload, right? Because it's dilating your blood vessels. Now, your PDE4 inhibitors, again, these drugs increase cyclic AMP, so you should already know what they will do to smooth muscle. They will cause relaxation of smooth muscle. For example, the smooth muscle in your airways, right? If you give a PDE4 inhibitor, your cyclic AMP levels go up, you relax the smooth muscle of the that lines your airways, like your trachea and stuff like that, okay? And you get bronchodilation. That's how drugs like theophylline. Theophylline is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. And the roflumilast. Roflumilast is a drug that's actually used to treat COPD, like end-stage COPD. So, again, mechanism of action makes sense because you want to open up airways for those people. And then your PDE5 inhibitors, I already talked about that. Drugs like sildenafil, tadalafil, they increase your levels of cyclic GMP, okay? They're used to treat erectile dysfunction. And in addition to that, they're also used to treat pulmonary hypertension, pulmonary arterial hypertension. Okay, so next thing I'll just talk about, just kind of a grab bag of things before I go into the anti-fat medications. But basically, torsadapuant. For torsadapuant, remember you give MAG, right? And the thing is, MAG, no one really knows how MAG works, but MAG is used for many things, right? That you should know for your exam. One is you can use MAG for torsadapuant. Remember, it's a kind of polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, and it can arise in the setting of a QT prolongation. You can also use MAG as a tocolytic, okay? Because the thing is, MAG can actually decrease the contraction of the uterus for, you know, like 2 to 3 days, right? So if you want to delay pregnancy, let's assume mom is about to deliver a preterm baby and you want to give like steroids to promote fetal lung maturity, you can give MAG to sort of slow down the pregnancy, prevent contractions for a few days, okay, for the fetal lungs to mature, at least to get your 2 doses of betamethasone, okay? And then don't forget that MAG is also the treatment of choice for eclampsia, right, where a patient is having seizures, or even as prophylaxis, if a patient has like preeclampsia, right, before they get to that stage where they have seizures, you can give MAG for that. And then don't forget that MAG also decreases the risk of cerebral palsy. Okay, so this is more for your third year, but it can be like a bizarre question on step one, right? So if a mom is about to deliver a baby and it's less than 32 weeks, you can actually, basically the buzzword is neuroprotection. You can decrease the risk of cerebral palsy in that kid by giving magnesium. Now, magnesium also has some effects on PTH actually, right? So the thing is, if you have very high levels of magnesium, think of it as having very high levels of calcium, your PTH release will be decreased, right? So high MAG levels decrease the release of PTH, okay? But for low MAG levels, there are two things you want to know. You want to know if you have low levels of MAG or super low levels of MAG. When you have low levels of MAG, okay, that is like having low levels of calcium. Your level, your PTH release will be increased. But if you have super, super, super like low levels of magnesium, that actually also decreases the release of PTH. So let me summarize. If your PTH levels are high, if your MAG levels are high, you decrease your release of PTH just like you do for calcium. If your MAG levels are low, you increase your release of PTH just like you do for calcium. But if your MAG levels are super, 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 super low, you will actually also decrease your release of PTH, which is paradoxical. And then one other thing I want to mention, right? If you're hypomagnesemic, remember you can get a QT prolongation from that. Remember the rule I've mentioned many times, that if you have any notable hypo disorder, that can cause QT prolongation, like hypocalcemia, hypomagnesemia, hypokalemia, right? Those can all cause QT prolongation. But one other high yield thing I want you to know is if you're hypomagnesemic, you will not respond to potassium and calcium supplementation. So classic exam question, patient is hypocalcemic, you're giving calcium. Their calcium levels are not increasing in the blood. The reasoning behind that is because they're hypomagnesemic. So your next step in management may actually be to check their levels of magnesium. Because the thing is, if you're hypomagnesemic, it causes your kidneys to waste a lot of ions, especially calcium and potassium. Okay, so you want to replete those people's magnesium levels, and then things will kick back into gear. And one telltale sign of magnesium toxicity is when you have like decreased deep tendon reflexes. They classically make this an OB question on exams, right? So like an OB-GYN question. So they tell you about a patient that has preeclampsia. They're on a magnesium infusion. And then they say, like, what's the next step in management, right? You want to do periodic checks of their deep tendon reflexes, right? Because that's like the first sign of magnesium toxicity, a decrease in your deep tendon reflexes. If you don't catch it and their mag levels keep going up, okay, you will have respiratory depression. If you don't catch it then, and then their levels keep going up, they'll go to flat lines, right? Asystole. Okay, and then that's, I mean, you're dead, right, if you're in asystole, right? So you want to watch that. And actually, the way you reverse magnesium toxicity is also with calcium gluconate. Remember, calcium gluconate is also the first drug you give if a patient has hyperkalemia to protect the myocardium. Any calcium-containing compound can reverse mag toxicity. And then some other quick things about blood pressure. I've mentioned this before, but if a patient has BPH and hypertension, right, you obviously want to give an alpha blocker, okay, because that would open up the bladder neck, but also dilate their blood vessels and reduce blood pressure, right? But if you only have BPH, you want to give tamsulosin, right? Tamsulosin, it's also an alpha-1 blocker, but it's an alpha-1 AD blocker, which is the one you only find in the bladder, okay? It does not affect your blood vessels. Now, if a patient has hypertension and diabetes, right, obviously you want to give ACE inhibitors or ARBs, right? Now, what's the mechanism behind that, right? The thing is, if a patient has diabetic kidney disease, remember, diabetes affects the glomerular capillaries, but remember that it also causes a non-enzymatic glycosylation of the efferent arterioles, okay? The vessels that drain blood from the glomerular capillaries. So the thing is, if you cause non-enzymatic glycosylation of the efferent arteriole, you basically constrict those efferent arterioles, and that would increase your GFR. Like, sort of think of it as like a permanent problem. If your efferent arterioles are always like kind of stenosed, you will raise the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerular capillaries. That will increase your GFR, right? The thing is, if your GFR is not meant to be high all the time, it's supposed to, you know, be regulated, right? You never want to be at the extreme end of anything in life all the time. You want to be like, you know, sort of kept within a relatively constant range. So if your GFR is always high, that will ultimately damage your glomerular capillaries, right? That's something known as hyperfiltration injury. You're getting that hyperfiltration injury because there's intraglomerular hypertension, okay? Hyperfiltration injury from intraglomerular hypertension. So, that can over time cause damage, right? And then you begin to have microalbuminuria and then get macroalbuminuria and then go into end-stage kidney disease as a diabetic, okay? And again, if you have diabetes and you have microalbuminuria, you need to be put on an ACE inhibitor, so or an ARB. So even if, and the reason those work, right? Remember that angiotensin 2 causes constriction, right? So when angiotensin 2 acts on receptors, it causes a constriction of the efferent arteriole. So if you give an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, you will basically remove the effects of angiotensin 2. So instead of having constriction of your efferent arteriole, you have dilation of your efferent arteriole, and that will lower the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerular capillaries, and that will basically cut down or slow down the rate of degeneration of the glomerular capillaries in diabetes, right? And don't forget though, right, if you're lowering that hydrostatic pressure, you should already divine that, actually that's the correct English use of the term, but you should already imagine that the GFR will go down, right? So that's why ACE inhibitors and ARBs are kind of contraindicated in people that have bilateral renal artery stenosis, because ACE inhibitors, ARBs, when you give those things, the GFR goes down, so your creatinine goes up. Okay. So again, if you have diabetes and you have microalbuminuria, even if you don't have hypertension, it doesn't matter. You need to be put on an ACE inhibitor and ARB. This is a very common question in third year. So I guess we can jump into the anti-lipid medications. I guess while we're on that topic, because I don't really see anywhere else where I could, throw this in. So it probably makes sense to, you know, go ahead and discuss it now. But basically, one drug I think I want to mention is Orlistat. Orlistat is used as a weight loss drug, right? It's an inhibitor of pancreatic lipase. It also inhibits gastric lipase, right? By inhibiting lipase, you don't break down fat, you don't reabsorb it, right? And then you basically poop it out. But obviously, right, steatorrhea, right, and like diarrhea will be like side effects of orlistat. So this is one of those weird things you want to know. And another weird thing is it also apparently inhibits fatty acid synthase. So if you inhibited fatty acid synthase, you don't make fat. And again, you don't build up fat in the body. It's one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So, but these anti-lipid medications, people are like, oh, Divine, there are so many of them, so hard to understand. But the thing is, a lot of them make sense, right? So I feel like, and I know I've done this, I believe I've done this in my biochemo video, but I'm going to do it again real quick here for like 5 minutes. Talk about the biochemistry of lipids. If I talk about that, I think it'll make it much easier for you to remember and understand these anti-lipid medications, right? So, quick spiel on the biochemistry of lipids, right? So let's assume you consume fat, right? When you consume fat, you release lipase from the pancreas, right? That lipase will break down the triglyceride you just consumed into MAG, so monoacylglycerol, and two free fatty acids, okay? And then with the help of bile, you basically reabsorb these monoacylglycerol and the two free fatty acids into the enterocyte. And then inside the enterocyte, right, that MAG and the free fatty acids, they are made right back into a triglyceride. Okay, but the thing is that triglyceride cannot just, you know, travel on its own in the blood. The thing is that triglyceride is bonded with cholesterol, right, to form something called a cholesterol ester, right? So if you remember from organic chemistry in college, right, if you have a reaction between a carboxylic acid and an alcohol, right, it's like a condensation reaction, you form an ester. Right. So cholesterol all has an alcohol group. Right. And then you're having a fatty acid, which is almost like a carboxylic acid reacting with it. So that's why you form a cholesterol ester. OK. And the thing is, the enzyme that makes that reaction work is known as ACAT. OK. ACAT. Right. So ACAT is like, I think it's like acyl-CoA cholesterol acyltransferase, or ACAT for short. So ACAT makes that reaction happen. And then before that cholesterol ester leaves the GI tract, right, it partners up with ApoB48, okay? Remember, like, the ApoB48 is made by alternative splicing from ApoB100. It's just one of those weird biochem things they can sort of, I mean, cell biology things they can sort of slide into your exam, okay? And please don't forget that one key enzyme that helps you make that ApoB48 is something known as MTP, microsomal transfer protein, okay? Microsomal transfer protein helps you make ApoB48, okay? And don't forget also that alternative splicing is how you make IgD, okay? That's how IgD is basically a derivative of IgM, okay? You make that by alternative splicing. So the cholesterol ester plus ApoB48 together is what's known as the chylomicron, okay? And one quick thing I'll just sort of say here is that HDL, the molecule, has four things with it, okay? In fact, HDL is a combination of four things. Number one, ApoE. Number two, ApoC2. Number three, LCAT. And number four, ApoA1, okay? So again, I'll mention that again. HDL has four components, ApoE, ApoC2, LCAT, and ApoA1. And the thing is, that ApoE and ApoC2, HDL donates it to other things, as you'll see as we go along. And then that LCAT is kind of an enzyme that HDL uses to either like make itself and also to collect cholesterol from the periphery, okay? To sort of clear your system of cholesterol. So let's continue this chylomicron story, right? So HDL, as I already discussed, donates the ApoE and ApoC2 to the chylomicron, okay? And then that chylomicron encounters an adipocyte, okay? And adipocytes, they have a membrane enzyme known as LPL, lipoprotein lipase. That lipoprotein lipase helps you cleave the chylomicron, okay? And when it cleaves the chylomicron, the thing that you're left with is something called the remnant of the chylomicron, or the chylomicron remnant, right? And that chylomicron remnant has ApoE, okay? So why do we need that ApoC2 from HDL in the first place? The thing is, ApoC2 is a cofactor for LPL, for lipoprotein lipase, okay? Lipoprotein lipase's job is to break down the triglyceride. Because the thing is, triglycerides cannot be reabsorbed across the membrane of enterocytes. So you need to break them down outside the adipocyte into monoacylglycerol and 2-free fatty acids, and that's done by lipoprotein lipase, okay? And then when you break them down, you reabsorb them, and then you remake them into triglycerides in adipocytes as well, okay? And again, the enzyme that makes that happen is lipoprotein lipase. So think about it. This process involves you storing fat, so it should make sense that insulin upregulates the activity of lipoprotein lipase, okay? So you're from the triglyceride in the cell, right? And then basically the chylomicron remnant, it still has ApoE. It travels with that, okay? And then there's an ApoE receptor on the surface of the liver that binds to that ApoE on the surface of the chylomicron and accepts that chylomicron back into the liver, okay? That's the end of the road for the chylomicron. Although remember, the chylomicron can basically travels through your lymphatic system, right? So if you transect like a lymphatic duct, like your thoracic duct, that can cause a particular kind of pleural effusion known as a chylothorax, okay? Chylothorax. Now, but the thing is, it's not only your enterocytes that can deal with triglycerides, right? The thing is, your hepatocytes, your liver cells, can also deal with triglycerides, right? But again, same story, just like we had in the enterocyte, right? That triglyceride cannot travel on its own, right? So it's bound to cholesterol, it's made into a cholesterol ester. But the thing is, instead of getting married to ApoB48 like we have in the enterocyte, we get the cholesterol ester that's made in the hepatocyte marries ApoB100. Okay, marries ApoB100. And the cholesterol ester made in the hepatocyte plus ApoB100 is known as VLDL. Okay, VLDL. And then, again, VLDL travels in the circulation, picks up ApoC2 and ApoE from HDL. And then, on the surface of adipocytes, ApoC2 acts as a cofactor for lipoprotein lipase. That breaks down, that basically, like, helps you get rid of triglycerides from VLDL. Right? And the thing you have at the end of that process is known as IDL, intermediate density lipoprotein. Okay? And then there is another weird enzyme in the body known as hepatic lipase. Hepatic lipase. Again, hepatic lipase. That hepatic lipase takes that IDL and converts it to LDL. Okay? And then when you've made LDL, LDL then returns ApoC2 and ApoE back to HDL. So you may say, Divine, but if LDL returns ApoE back to HDL, then how does it get back into the liver? Well, remember that LDL still has ApoB100. It so happens that there is an ApoB100 receptor. In fact, another name for the ApoB100 receptor is LDL receptor. That's found on the surface of hepatocytes that you can use to clear hepatocytes from the serum. I mean, that you can use to clear LDL from the serum, sorry. So, and don't forget, right, if you want to make cholesterol, the rate-limiting enzyme is what? HMG-CoA reductase, okay? They will try to put HMG-CoA synthase on your exam. Please don't pick that. HMG-CoA synthase is used in many pathways, like ketone body synthesis. It's used in cholesterol synthesis, okay? But the rate-limiting enzyme for cholesterol synthesis is HMG-CoA reductase, okay? It converts mevalonate to something. Okay. Now, so what are the fates of LDL, right? So the thing is, LDL has two fates, right? So LDL, 80% of it is taken back to the liver, right? It's taken up by the LDL receptor. And the thing is, when the LDL receptor binds to LDL, right? Remember, another name for the LDL receptor is the ApoB100 receptor. When the LDL receptor binds to LDL, it brings the LDL with the cholesterol attached to it into the hepatocyte, and then the LDL receptor is broken down by an enzyme known as what's the name of this enzyme? PCSK9. Right, PCSK9 breaks down the LDL receptor into like inactive stuff, okay? Breaks it down into inactive stuff. And one thing I guess I forgot to mention is that LDL can actually accept cholesterol from HDL, which is not a good thing, because LDL dumps cholesterol in your periphery. You don't want that, right? HDL takes cholesterol away from your periphery. But the thing is, there's an enzyme that can take that cholesterol, take it from HDL, and put it on LDL, which is a bad thing, obviously, right? And the thing that makes... Well, actually, it's not always a bad thing, right? Because LDL actually does some good things, right? Because your cells, your cell membranes, right, that are made of phospholipids need cholesterol, right? It's when your LDL is high that that's bad, right? So let's assume you had a disease where you have high levels of LDL, right? Like hyperlipidemia. You want to give something that inhibits that enzyme that makes cholesterol go from HDL to LDL. That enzyme is known as CETP, cholesterol ester transfer protein. They're actually drugs that inhibit that enzyme, but I suspect that you will likely not see those on step one, because many of those drugs have not really worked, although I think there is one that recently sort of like made the cut and may go into like you may begin to use it. You may begin to use prescribe it to patients. Well, although I even say that it will probably be like super expensive. But let's get back to this. So PCSK9 breaks down the LDL receptor in hepatocytes into something inactive, okay? And then the other fate of LDL, besides the 80% that goes to the liver, is the 20% basically dumps cholesterol in the periphery, okay? So again, keep those two things in mind. Now, HDL, what's the deal with HDL, right? So the thing is, HDL, like I said, it collects cholesterol from the periphery, okay? Converts it to a cholesterol ester, okay? And it does that with LCAT. Just like ACAT helped you make cholesterol esters in enterocytes, LCAT helps you make cholesterol esters with HDL, okay? And LCAT actually uses ApoA1 as a cofactor, okay? Just like lipoprotein lipase used ApoC2 as a cofactor, LCAT uses ApoA1 as a cofactor. Very high yield to know that, okay? And again, I've talked about the cholesterol ester transfer protein. So now that you understand the biochem of lipids, then the pharmacology of lipids makes perfect sense, right? So obviously the first drugs we'll start with are the statins, okay? The statins inhibit HMG-CoA reductase, okay? So let's talk about the mechanism behind these drugs lowering your cholesterol levels, right? This is something they love to test on step one and also on step two and also on shelf exams, because it's something that people just don't get for some bizarre reason. So these drugs are the best drugs to lower LDL. Okay, and the thing is, how do these drugs work? The thing is, if you inhibit HMG-CoA reductase, the levels, the intracellular concentration of cholesterol with hepatocytes goes down, right? So the amount of cholesterol inside hepatocytes goes down, okay? So when hepatocytes don't have enough cholesterol, they begin to freak out, right? Because they need cholesterol for many things. They begin to freak out, and when they begin to freak out, they begin to express a lot of LDL receptors, okay? So when they express more LDL receptors, they capture more LDL from the circulation, and that basically increases the clearance of LDL from the circulation, right? Because the LDL has the cholesterol that the liver is looking for, okay? This is, again, this is like floridly high yield to know. This is the primary mechanism of action behind statins lowering your LDL. They increase the expression of LDL receptors. You need to remember this buzz phrase for your step one exam. Now, classic drugs here, they all end in statin: atorvastatin, lovastatin, pravastatin, simvastatin, rosuvastatin, whatever, okay? So let's say some more things about the statins, right? So I said that ultimately, right, mevalonate is involved in that cholesterol synthesis pathway. So the thing is, mevalonate is actually used to make coenzyme Q. Remember that coenzyme Q is actually a part of the cholesterol, it's part of the electron transport chain, right? So if you're taking a HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor, right, you have ultimately will have decreased levels of coenzyme Q. If your levels of coenzyme Q go down, think about it, you potentially have decreased ATP synthesis, right? And if you have decreased ATP synthesis because your electron transport chain is short, your sodium potassium ATPase pump will stop working. And if it's not working, right, sodium will flow down its gradient into cells. If sodium flows down its gradient into cells, water will follow. Your cells can swell and explode, okay? So this is potentially the mechanism behind the myotoxicity that people get with statins. Now, another thing is that I said that for you to make VLDL, right, cholesterol binds with triglycerides, right, to form a cholesterol ester that then forms VLDL along with ApoB100. The thing is, if you inhibit HMG-CoA reductase, you're no longer making cholesterol, and the intracellular amount of cholesterol in your hepatocytes go down, then it's like your triglycerides kind of hang out in the liver, right? And they could potentially cause like fatty liver, Okay, so this is the potential mechanism behind the hepatotoxicity that goes along with statins. So the big toxicities you want to know your statins are hepatotoxicity and myotoxicity. Now, the next drugs I'll talk about are the fibrates. Okay, your fibrates, they are PPAR alpha activators. Okay, so think of like PPAR, I think it stands for like peroxisome proliferator activated receptor alpha. Okay, so they are PPAR alpha activators. Okay, remember PPAR alpha is actually a transcription factor for LPL, for lipoprotein lipase, right? So think about this: if you activate PPAR alpha, you're increasing the you're activating a transcription factor for lipoprotein lipase. If you activate lipoprotein lipase some, if you make more lipoprotein lipase because you're increasing its transcription, right, you basically clear triglycerides from the serum. This is why fibrates are the best drugs for lowering triglycerides. Now, please do not confuse PPAR alpha with PPAR gamma. Okay, do not confuse PPAR alpha or PPAR gamma. PPAR gamma is what is affected by your TZDs, your thiazolidinediones, which are drugs used for diabetes. Okay, and the classic drugs that you see on exams with the fibrates are like gemfibrozil, right, fenofibrate, clofibrate, phenofibrate, blah blah blah. Okay, and these drugs, you don't want to give them with statins because there's an increased risk of myotoxicity. Okay, and let's see, this podcast has gone on for long, so I don't have the time for that. But these drugs also increase your risk of gallstones. That's something high you have to know for step one. And don't forget that these drugs also inhibit cytochrome P450. Okay, so again, just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. Now, the next drugs I'll talk about are your bile acid binding resins, right? Your bile acid binding agents, right? So there are drugs like cholestyramine, cholestipol, cholecalciferol. Remember, bile is made from cholesterol, right? And please don't forget, right, the rate limiting enzyme in bile synthesis, bile acid synthesis, is 7-alpha-hydroxylase. So bile is made from cholesterol, right? So the thing is, if you bind up bile, your liver is like, oh crap, why do I not have bile? So your liver tries to increase its synthesis of bile. So your liver, by increasing the synthesis of bile, is increasing the utilization of cholesterol. If you increase the utilization of cholesterol, well, guess what? Your liver is like, oh no, I don't have enough cholesterol in my hepatocytes. So by so doing, your liver will also increase the expression of LDL receptors, and that will clear more LDL from your serum. Okay, because again, LDL has cholesterol that the liver can use. So again, these drugs are good at lowering blood LDL, but they're not as good as statins. Statins are the best drugs for lowering LDL, okay? But there are a few problems with these drugs, right? Obviously, right? You have a fat-soluble vitamin deficiency, right? Because you need bile to emulsify those fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A, D, E, and K, right? So your ADEC vitamins. And then, don't forget, right? These drugs can cause a diarrhea, right? Because the bile is sort of hanging in your GI tract, right? So these people, they can get steatorrhea. You probably don't want to hang out with these people on a plane ride, right? Because you'll get a new definition, or you have an appreciated understanding of what a very good fart smells like. Okay. Now, one weird unusual thing you may get, and don't forget, please don't forget, I'm just saying this to integrate some pathology here, but don't forget that bile is reabsorbed in the terminal ileum, just like vitamin B12, okay? Remember that whole business with enterohepatic recirculation. Okay, now, one other weird thing with the bile acid binding resins, especially cholestyramine. Cholestyramine is very good at binding C. diff toxin, okay? So it's just one of those weird things you want to keep in mind, right? So you can actually use it as one of the adjuncts to the treatment of a pseudomembranous colitis. Although pseudomembranous colitis these days is treated with vancomycin. Vancomycin is now the first-line agent, no longer metronidazole. Okay, now ezetimibe is the next one. Basically, ezetimibe prevents the reabsorption of lipids in the GI tract. That's literally all you need to know. And then niacin. No one really knows how niacin works, but high yield thing you want to know, niacin is the best drug at increasing HDL. Now, one of the high yield thing you want to know with niacin is niacin, right? There are actually receptors that respond to niacin on the surfaces of mast cells, right? So if you take niacin, right, niacin can bind to those receptors on mast cells. That'll cause a degranulation of those mast cells, and they'll release things like histamine, right, and prostaglandins, right? So remember, histamine and prostaglandins, they cause vasodilation, so that's why you can get flushing with niacin. But another thing that can happen is histamine causes itching, right? So you can get an itch, like very bad I'm forgetting the medical term now for itching, but you can itch a lot with niacin. So the way you can actually prevent this is you just tell the patient to tough it out, right? After a while, the effects sort of go away. But one thing you can do is you can give, like, you can pre-treat the patient with aspirin, right, or a COX inhibitor. Because by inhibiting COX, you don't make prostaglandins, right? And if you don't make prostaglandins, you're basically taking away the stuff that can come from mast cells in degranulation, like prostaglandins, right? Although you still have the histamine. But in general, if you give an NSAID, a COX inhibitor, that sort of takes care of the itching and the flushing that goes with a niacin. And then the next drugs I want to talk about, the PCSK9 inhibitors. Remember I said that PCSK9 breaks down LDL receptors inside hepatocytes. So if you inhibit PCSK9, you will stop breaking down LDL receptors. They will persist for a longer time period on the surface of hepatocytes. So you will increase the clearance of LDL from the circulation. These drugs work extremely well, okay? Only problem is they're very expensive. But the big ones you want to know here, they all end in QMAB, right? So like evolocumab, alirocumab, okay? They are all monoclonal antibodies against the PCSK9 enzyme. Now, one other drug I want to talk about is mypomersin. This can be an unusual drug you may see on your exam that pretty much everyone will get wrong, but you won't get it wrong because you listen to this podcast. But they can make this into like a cell biology question on step one, right? So how can they do that? The thing is, mypomersin is actually an antisense RNA, okay, against the mRNA of ApoB100, okay? So basically, it basically cuts down on the amount of ApoB100 you have, because you don't make it anymore because you just always kill the mRNA. So by doing that, you decrease the release of VLDL from hepatocytes. If you decrease the release of VLDL from hepatocytes, well, guess what? You basically will never make LDL. If you don't make LDL, guess what? Your LDL levels will be low. Okay, so they may make this a genetic experiment question on step one. The thing is, this drug, super powerful, but it's super expensive. But classically, it's used to treat like the familial hypercholesterolemias. And I think that's it for these lipid drugs. I guess let me just say some quick things about three other drugs here. Methergine is another drug. It's used more for OB. No one really knows how it works. But basically, it's used to treat postpartum hemorrhage, okay? Because it can sort of like constrict the uterine vessels. Only problem is you don't want to give this to people that have a history of vasospastic disease, right? So people that have like Raynaud's phenomenon or like Prinz Meadows angina, also called variant angina, or preeclampsia, right? Preeclampsia, people believe that it arises from like vasospasm as well, okay? So you want to avoid methergine in those people. The other drug I want to talk about is neseritide. Neseritide is an analog of BMP, of brain natriuretic peptide. Remember that BMP actually increases guanylate cyclase activity, right? And it also increases diuresis, right? So it lowers your blood volume, but it also, which lowers your blood pressure, but it also causes vasodilation, right? So these drugs can be used to treat a heart failure, okay? So neseritide is a drug that actually helps with that. It's a BMP analog. And then the last drug I'll talk about is sacubitril. I do not believe that sacubitril is in first aid, but I can almost predict that this drug will make its way to an NBME exam at some point in the not too distant future. The thing is, how does sacubitril work? Sacubitril is a neprilysin inhibitor. Well, what is neprilysin? Neprilysin is an enzyme that breaks down AMP, that's atrial natriuretic peptide, and BMP, brain-type natriuretic peptide. And I already just told you that these AMP-BMP cause vasodilation and increased diuresis. They actually also blunt the effects of the renin angiotensin aldosterone system, which is amazing, right? So these drugs are good for heart failure. Okay, so if you gave a neprilysin inhibitor like sacubitril, your levels of AMP and BMP will go up because they're no longer broken down and you get all those awesome effects. Okay, in fact, sacubitril is now combined in a drug. If you watch TV, there's this drug known as Entresto. It's like this popular ad where like some old guy is saying like, tomorrow, I love you, tomorrow, right? So it's like Entresto. Entresto is a heart failure drug. It has actually been shown to have some benefit, but basically Entresto is a combination of an ACE inhibitor and sacubitril. Okay, works really well for certain subsets of heart failure, especially when you reach certain like New York Heart Association classifications. So I think this is where I'm going to stop. And really, this is the end of cardiac pharmacology. So I know these were a long series of podcasts, but if you listen to the three CardioPharm podcasts, you will learn not just the drugs, but you'll learn a lot of cardiac pathologies, a lot of arrhythmia stuff and whatnot. So I wish you all the best. Again, happy Thanksgiving. God bless, and I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.